Boys and girls, ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to my podcast, Coffees on Me, David Kwan, where I strive to give guests legacy-worthy interviews that listeners then enjoy while cooking, commuting, relaxing, or walking their pets. A particularly good week for me in London. I'm being very reflective and made a lot of life progresses, but today was tremendously chaotic with locking myself out of my room, and my guests are now actually at a local park, just sitting on the lawn, enjoying the sunshine, which is really good weather, and our cappuccino. Also, because I've locked myself out of my room, my computers, I also can't access it, so I'm accessing my notes on my phone for the interview, which is chaotic, but very exciting. Anyway, I feel very blessed that we're now approaching 100,000 podcast downloads. Please know that I don't take any of your time, feedback, and support for granted, because when I started this passion project podcast at a low point of my time in Cambridge, I was genuinely motivated by three founding ideals. Number one, purpose of giving. Number two, learning from others. And number three, sharing of stories, which are aspirations that still make up the content description. I say this all the time, but very truly, the opportunities to strive to give my courageous and insightful guests legacy-worthy interviews over coffee, tea, bubble tea, or water, despite my many inadequacies, or even in a park like today without my notes, have been a tremendous privilege that imbues me with gratitude. I know that I will listen back and laugh at, you know, how naive I am, but if you have been during the discussions on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, YouTube, or wherever you listen to podcasts, thank you. And please do consider leaving a review and nominating a guest by contacting me via my link tree, David Kwan. Seeing this podcast on people's Spotify Wraps last year, or receiving positive messages about the guests themselves, give me tremendous fulfillment. I cannot thank the wonderful guests enough for their courage and insights. I genuinely maintain the deep conviction that this passion project, if wholly true to those founding motivations about giving, learning, and sharing, is a worthwhile pursuit. So now on to my incredibly talented, easygoing, patient, and cool guest. Annie Chan is an up-and-coming global pop star. She insists that I make this a joke, but it's not a joke. You heard it here first. Annie is going into her third year studying music at St. Catherine's College, University of Cambridge, and is a choral scholar, having recently toured Rome with the college choir, as well as enjoying writing more acoustic indie folk songs that she performs at chilled college open mics that she helps to run with the college's music society. As well as being a multi-instrumentalist, the piano diplomas and two grade 8 distinctions speak for themselves. She is striving to become a music producer and composer after graduating, writing tracks in a range of styles, a few of which can be found on her Spotify and SoundCloud pages. Beyond music, Annie has dabbled in various societies during her time at Cambridge, including the ADC scene, but ultimately her love for helping people has resulted in her being both the JCR Welfare Rep for Cats and winning a Community Spirit Award for her work on the committee, as well as working hard to raise money for breast cancer charities with Pink Week for the past 2 years. These have been incredibly rewarding positions, and she hopes her third year at Cambridge will offer opportunities equally exciting and enriching. Annie, chaotic morning, but welcome to my podcast, Coffees on Me, David Kwan.
Thank you. It's lovely to be here, sat in this lovely park with you today.
How are you this holidays?
I'm good. I'm quite bored. I feel ready to go back to Cambridge, although perhaps not for the stress of final year. But yeah.
That's so exciting. I mean, I find summer holidays usually is such a great time to look back. And obviously, I don't know everything about your life, but as I was doing kind of a bit of research on you over the week, and just, I don't think, has anyone won more Christmas carol competitions than you? You must make Mrs. Wiber very proud.
I do love a good Christmas carol competition. I have many Christmas carols in the archives. Maybe we'll do one at Cats someday.
Yeah.
But I find the summer holidays is also good actually to look forward. Or I find that I've been doing that a lot this holiday in terms of looking forward to post uni and the future and everything.
That's so exciting. And right now, what's like the one goal that you have?
I'd really, really like to get onto the electronic and produced music course at Guildhall, the postgrad course.
Then you get to live around here.
Yeah, I get to live in sunny Islington. It looks like the perfect course for me. I went to Guildhall Junior, so it'd be a nice full circle moment.
What would it take to get admission?
Well, I have to do a portfolio of work and an interview and something which they call a creative task, which I'm not quite sure what that entails.
I would assume that everyone applying for that would be creative, right?
Well, you would like to think, but who knows?
Yeah.
We'll find out.
So within your current portfolio, you've released two singles and particularly, I guess they're quite different, but they're also quite emotional. Do you want to maybe talk a bit about both songs and how it came to be?
Yeah, so the first song, Feeling Wavy, was actually the second song I've ever produced.
I love that. First song was actually the second song.
My first song that I ever produced was not good. I thought it was amazing at the time, and I listen back to it now.
What was that called?
It's called Dehumanized. I think it's actually on my SoundCloud. It's really not good. So Feeling Wavy was the second song, and that's all about just being, I guess, completely infatuated with someone. I'm sure we all know the feeling. And then the second song on my Spotify, Still Wish You Were Mine, it's kind of what it says on the tin. It's Still Wish You Were Mine. But that's quite a funny song, actually. Well, I look back at it now and laugh. It's got quite a funny story behind it, because...
that we cannot play. It's a helicopter going through.
My thunder's been stolen. So Still Wish You Were Mine. Generally, I write all my songs not about specific things. I kind of draw on a few different events, a few different people. But there was a lot of... there was a lot of rumours because I released it about 2 days before going back to Cambridge for my second year of Michaelmas, and there was a lot of rumours that it was about someone in college. And I think he is really sad that it's about him. And it was just quite funny at the time, because not all my songs are about specific things, and although I can be inspired by, it doesn't mean it's about him. But I think maybe he's proud that
got
he
a song
sort of has
dedicated.
A song about him, though it's not the most complimentary, so I'm not sure I'd be...
That's Feeling Wavy.
No, Still Wish You Were Mine.
Okay.
Yeah. That's quite...
So, funny. In one of the Cat's media articles that came out, you were quoted as saying how my new single draws on influences from far and wide, pop and indie music, in particular the art and music associated with synthwave, and an amalgamation of people and feelings.
Yeah.
Listening to Conor Gray's Wish You Were Sober was the catalyst that gave me a phase on which to build a song, and I was able to finesse the original draft between May and July 2022. So I was wondering, this artistic inspiration stage is always, I think, historically, everyone wants to find out, you know, whether there's a formula, whether there is a way to be creative. It seems like from your quote there that you can't really force it, and it just kind of comes about.
Not. I mean, I think that's actually what's so frustrating about being creative, is that you can't force it, and sometimes you just have to take a step back and think, I have creative block at the moment, I can't get past it, I need a bit of space, which I think for a lot of artists, including myself, can be really hard to get. But I also find that I don't have any formula really for writing. I have tools in my toolbox that I'll use that will help, but every song or every piece that I've written generally comes about differently. So I think for Feeling Wavy, for example, I came up with the chorus of that really quite quickly in about like 10 minutes or so. I had the chords laid down, but then I kind of worked out from the chorus into writing the verses, which took a bit longer. But Still Wish You Were Mine was definitely more of a, well, it was a slower process. I found the chords, hummed some melodies, and then it was writing in the lyrics from, I used actually quite a few other songs that I'd written, kind of drew lyrics from all of them, because quite often I'll write songs quickly and then I go back and look at them and I'm like, oh, I'm actually talking about a few different things.
Yeah.
I'm not talking, it's not coherent, but this lyric would be good in a song about this.
Well, so when you're compiling the different lyrics from different sources, how do you feel emotionally? Like, do you lose sense of time? Are you processing? Is it cathartic? Does it stir you up? You know, what kind of feelings do you feel?
I'd say it's quite cathartic for me, songwriting. I generally try not to write about something until I've processed it. Whereas I know some people write about their feelings like straight after an event, or like straight after something quite traumatizing, they'll write it down. I don't find that particularly helpful. I like to leave it a little bit and then kind of almost like journaling a few months later is how I would view
writing. Do you keep a diary?
No, I've tried many times, but I feel, it's odd, journaling feels very performative for me. Like I'm writing something for someone to then read when I die or something morbid like that. But then it's funny because songwriting doesn't feel like that, but I put my songs out into the world, so they are performative. It's odd. I don't know.
So you're just accepting that it is meant to be for that.
Yeah, I think so.
So when you're writing the lyrics, and I'm thinking of what you said earlier about, you know, the rumours and the college and everything. So how much do you worry about others' people's perception about you based on what they read of your lyrics?
Ooh, that's a good question. I, again, think it depends on the song. So some songs I would never put out there because I think that would make me too vulnerable. But I feel pretty detached from a lot of it. Definitely with Still Wish You Were Mine and all the rumours that happened around that. I just found it quite funny. it didn't really bother me. But I mean, I have a song coming out maybe around December, January time. I'm planning for it to come out, and that's probably my most vulnerable one yet. So I'm a bit more cautious, and I've taken a bit more care and time over the lyrics for that.
So the songs that have touched you, and I'd love for you to maybe give some examples or maybe even just lyrics. Why do you think it has touched you, and how does that affect how you do your performative writing?
Well, when I was younger, I loved Adele. And I think Adele really sings and writes from the heart. And I think that's definitely been, because I mean, I've been writing songs since primary school. I remember in year seven, actually, I wrote a song, and there was a music competition at school. And the song won, and I remember it was actually really depressing. I can't remember what it was called now, but it was not what you'd expect. Like, it was about love, and it was not what you'd expect a year seven to write.
You're quite emotionally mature.
Yeah, I don't want to say I am. I feel it.
Okay.
But I feel like when people are like, oh, I'm so emotionally mature, then it almost feels like bragging. But I'd say definitely those early influences, like Adele, in terms of her writing, her kind of diary entry writing, have been very influential on me. But I mean, I listen to so much music that it's hard to hard to pinpoint particular songs or particular artists.
And when you listen to music, do you listen to it while you're working, while you're studying, while you're walking? What's the context?
I listen to it all the time.
All the time. And then have there been moments when you just heard something that, oh, wow, that's amazing.
Yeah.
That moment, light bulb moment of, oh.
Yeah, I had that fairly recently. I wasn't listening to the song for the first time, actually. It's called Bloodless by Andrew Bird. It's my current favourite song. Mm. A friend had recommended the album a couple of years ago, and I listened to it then. And then I listened to it recently, and it was kind of just like a, oh my gosh, I forgot how good this is.
Mm-hmm.
Like, compositionally, lyrically. Mm. Yeah. I try to have a healthy balance between, I guess, close listening. Mm. So where I might be walking and I'm really focused on what I'm listening. Mm. And background listening. Mm.
What are for the people who haven't perhaps studied music extensively, because music's obviously something we can all enjoy, even if you don't fully understand the underlying composition, what are the components or segments or parts or elements that you listen to when you listen to a song that you think about?
Definitely the melody. Mm. I think having a catchy melody is quite a big thing, something you'll hum or whistle or even just like sing along to in the shower. Mm. And I think everyone, there's like a few universal songs that everyone knows the melody to.
Mm. What do you hum in the shower?
What do I hum in the shower? I quite often sing my own stuff, which makes me seem very self-obsessed. But I promise it's not in that way. maybe it's...
And then you look in the mirror and then you keep singing.
I'm just practicing for when I'm on the global stages. The lyrics as well, I think, are really important, and people listen to those a lot.
At least for me, and I don't know if I'm unique in that, but a lot of times I just know the melody, I know the tune, but I don't actually know the lyrics.
Yeah.
I don't know what it means.
I find that a lot, actually. Sometimes I love the Spotify feature where you can see the lyrics, because sometimes if I've got nothing to do, I'll just sit and I'll listen to music and I'll watch the lyrics on karaoke mode or whatever it is. And you get like a whole new appreciation for a song.
Because like recently, I just signed up to the company's choir. I'm not the most brilliant singer by any measure. I did do choir for a year in primary school, which I really enjoyed. But I think as a teenage boy, there's always that bit of shyness of going to choir. But I've always appreciated the beauty of singing and doing it together with other people.
Yeah.
So we were singing Hallelujah. You know, it was just a song that you always heard, you know, around religious places, in funerals, etc. And actually just focusing on the lyrics gave me a different appreciation of what it was. And I was wondering, because you're so attuned with the music and stuff, do you find it easier to capture the lyrics, or do you feel a need to know what the lyrics are?
I wouldn't say I necessarily feel a need to know what the lyrics are, because I think definitely you can still absolutely love a song and have no idea what the lyrics are. I mean, if you think like foreign songs in foreign languages,
you
can absolutely love them and have no idea what they're saying. I think because I do so much listening and close listening, I do become naturally more aware of the lyrics than perhaps people who just listen to music when they're, I don't know, cooking or something, focusing on something else. But then again, some songs I've listened to for many years and I still don't know what the lyrics are.
So when you recorded your song, you did it in your garden shed.
Yes.
And it was modified with blankets and pillows to improve the sound quality. Why did you choose that outdoor setting?
Because we live on a road, so, and it's at the bottom of a hill, so cars tend to go down at some speed.
Why don't you do it in a studio?
I can't afford it. And so going in the garden shed and soundproofing that is actually quite quiet.
Okay.
And because the shed's made of wood, you don't get any bounce back of the sound that you would in rooms at the back of the house. Like a bathroom, when you're in there, it's got really nice reflective sound quality generally, if it's like tiled and... Which is great for live performance, but for recording, you don't want any sound bounce back. So the wooden infrastructure of the shed plus all the soft furnishings mean that you get a tight sound. Obviously, in an ideal world, I'd use a studio.
Okay.
But too much money.
Fair enough, but I also think maybe that personalised setting and putting like... for you to think about how to create an ideal environment adds a sense of meaning and purpose, and it adds to your own personal like, motivation narrative that you really want to do it, and it's no one else could have created that song in that condition.
Definitely. And I think because I was saying earlier, I went to Junior Guildhall, and a lot of people who actually basically everyone who was at Junior Guildhall was wealthy. And I was a first study composer there. And I remember people would just be able to pay to produce their music in a studio and pay for the best equipment and the best like plugins, which you get on. So the digital audio workstation I use is Logic Pro with Apple, and the plugins are things like audio effects and sounds, and they could pay for the best stuff, and I never could. And I always felt a bit sad because I was like, I'm never going to be able to produce music that sounds as good as easily because I can't afford the best stuff.
Elitism in music.
But then I've definitely kind of the last couple of years realised, no, I can do it. It just requires more time and effort, but it's much more rewarding at the end to do something that's cost basically no money.
Do you feel like being like a female composer, like in a arguably male dominated... Is it actually a male dominated field? Or
I find in music generally... not so much now, or at least at Cambridge I found it's a pretty 50-50 split, but in composition specifically it's still very male dominated. I mean, I was the only girl in my composition workshop class at Guildhall, which had about 10 guys in it because there weren't that many composers. But that was really intimidating actually.
Why was it intimidating?
Because I feel... I'm trying to think of the best way to word this. I was just always... I would have ideas or I would have answers, but I could never get my words out. There would always be the slightly cocky and arrogant boys that always got there first. And sometimes I'd think to myself, well, you're not actually right of the answer of something. And I know that I could answer it better. Again, maybe that makes me cocky and arrogant, but I know I could answer it better. Or they just had a confidence that I think partly comes from being a boy that I just didn't have.
So you felt like in your head you had the general gist or concept of it, but you didn't have that burst of confidence to just voice it out.
Yeah, I was always too afraid of being... wrong. I think that's what's actually been really nice about coming to Cambridge and all the supervisions and everything, is I'm less afraid of being wrong now, because being wrong
means
you're making progress, and it's okay to be wrong. And sometimes I think when you're wrong it actually works out better because you find new ways of thinking about things so that you are right, and that can lead to other things instead of always being right and being set in your ways, if that makes sense.
And even when they confidently respond, it doesn't mean like someone's confidence does not imply their competence. Or...
Yeah, exactly. And that definitely took me quite a while to come to terms with. I mean, even I guess at Cambridge, there's a little bit of that now, but it's not... I think partly because of the college that I'm at, it's not so bad because the other music students at CATS are lovely.
Yeah, yeah. So thinking back to when other people could just seamlessly just record music in the studio, whatever they need, they'll just pay for it. It's just, there's like no friction.
Yeah.
Whereas you said you felt slightly sad and perhaps a bit jealous and in despair that you don't have... As it just didn't feel fair.
Yeah.
Did you speak to anyone about that?
Not really. I guess I've spoken to my mum and voiced my frustrations about it. And I have a really great teacher, mentor for electronic music. And I'm not sure what I said to him, but I will never forget him saying... like you can produce radio ready tracks with a USB microphone, like a cheap £60 microphone and a laptop. And he said, we've heard it before, like you can do it. And I feel like I always just have that in my head that if other people have done it, I can do it.
At that point, what does it mean to achieve and to do well and to be recognized? Is it to have a career in singing? Is it to be a global pop star? Like, what were the metrics in your head?
I've never wanted to be a performer, really. I'm much more of a writer than a performer, so I'm happy my tracks on Spotify are sung by someone else, and I'm happy to kind of take a more backstage view. But I guess the goal would be to produce and compose, whether that's classical, whether that's pop, whether it's my own stuff, whether it's not.
I guess with writing it, you know, as you said, your next song could be vulnerable. It is undoubtedly still tied with your own identity.
Yeah.
And often lots of musicians talk about this idea of, like, you know, finding yourself or honing yourself through it. And have you found yourself, like, not necessarily precisely, but have you got like a persona? Have you got a general character or nature to who you are through your music? Or is that still
kind
a process?
Of. It's still a process that's going on. I'd say actually this summer I've become a lot more confident in my musical style, my like pop musical style, which is the indie folk, because that's what suits my voice best. And also my like even just like clothing style and stuff like that. I feel there's... writing music and performing has helped me to embrace being a bit quirky in general, because I think it's always really easy to fit into molds of trends, or even like other pop artists can fit into certain molds that they think will make them successful, but I haven't found that. I found that
you need to be a little different.
I like being different. I like being a bit quirky, and music definitely helps me accept that part of myself.
How are you quirky?
What a question. I don't know. I feel like I just am.
So do you feel, but you clearly feel quirky.
Yeah.
Whether you are or not is up for debate, but you definitely feel it.
Well, I've always felt like I've never quite fit in.
Fit into?
Just like social groups, like school groups I never really had. Even at uni, I guess I fit in more, but I tend to like float a bit socially. So I guess in that respect, and in style, things that I like. Yeah.
Hmm. And in terms of friendship group, were you mainly hang out with musicians, or did you also hang out with people with very different interests?
At school, actually, I was basically only friends with people who did STEM.
Oh, okay.
Which is very, very different from everything that I do. I have one of my best friends from school plays the guitar and sings, but we never really bond, because we did GCSE music together, but we never really bonded until sixth form, and she wasn't doing music then. And at Guildhall, junior Guildhall, I didn't really have, I had a few people who I was friendly with, but I wouldn't say I had.
What's the commitment at junior Guildhall?
It's every Saturday for like 10 week terms.
And what do they expect out of participants or students?
They, quite a lot.
Because I think for that age, lots of girls or boys at that age would be more enjoying their social life, and I can imagine you on the weekends feeling a bit more pressure to do well and do better. And
I think I really enjoyed junior Guildhall, even though it wasn't, you know, that sociable. I guess some people made it really sociable. I found it a bit more difficult because I did composition and piano, which are very insular studies, whereas people, string players, people in orchestras and stuff, had more friends. But I think the pressure only really, for me, I didn't feel that much pressure. It was just to make sure I got everything done in the week as opposed to on the weekend. So it'd be the evenings after school. That would be when it might take its toll a bit more, because I had to do work for, and then homework as well, especially during, well, I found it most during GCSEs, because obviously sixth form was COVID, so it's a bit different. But GCSEs, it was hard to balance revision and Guildhall, so I still went up every Saturday, even during exams.
Right, right. And when you got there on Saturday, what's like a typical day or session?
Well, I'd have piano and composition one-on-one lessons.
Okay.
I was in a choir, and then I had some workshops and like general music theory classes.
Okay. And did you get along with your teacher? One-on-one teacher?
Yeah, I absolutely loved. I had three principal study teachers across my time. Piano composition and electronic composition. I loved all three of them. I missed them a lot. and I feel like they were really important in my kind of development.
How so?
Well, they were very supportive. And I think that's really important, especially actually in teen years, because everyone obviously knows that a supportive teacher is important for young children. But I think people sort of forget that for teens.
How did their support, how did you feel their support? Was there anything that they did, or just the general vibe?
Just the general vibe. And whenever I'd say that I wanted to maybe explore something a bit different, they'd always give me the resources for that and be happy to help. So for example, in piano, I wanted to do a bit of Alexander technique, which is bit like yoga, but a lot of performers do it, and my piano teacher is really happy to do that with me, which actually really helped, like, performance anxiety and stuff like that.
Okay. And in terms, have you ever like expressed your gratitude to those teachers that were supportive?
Just the usual Christmas card, Christmas present. I would like to get back in touch with my teacher. I'm still in touch with my electronic composition teacher, but definitely my piano and classical composition, I'd like to get back in touch. And just
do you
let
feel
them
like
know.
They were like, obviously our parents are, they know us well, and you know that they love us unconditionally, but did you feel like those teachers offered, like they knew you in a different way, a different capacity, that like did anyone you feel like really understand you, or was your identity almost scattered across the different people who understood you in a different manner or way?
I think I'd say probably more scattered. Mm. Definitely more scattered. I'd still say my mum's the person who understands me best fully.
Yeah.
But I think sometimes, especially my piano teacher, could tell if I had a bit of a bad week or was a bit stressed,
mm.
and just new ways to make me feel a bit better, even if she didn't have to say anything.
Mm.
And sometimes it's just nice to have a different adult figure doing that isn't just your parents.
Mm, mm. So at that point, was Cambridge a goal?
When did that become a goal? Cambridge, I think, became a goal in lower sixth. I hadn't really thought that much about uni before sixth form.
Mm.
But my sister went to Cambridge, so that was always sort of on the horizon. And some people had said to me, oh, like, you should consider Oxbridge for music because you're quite academically minded, so you'd get more out of that than a going to Guildhall Senior, for example, which was the other thing that I'd been considering. But COVID meant that I couldn't go up and visit, so I kind of just applied to Cambridge on a bit of a whim, applied to CATS, hoping that I'd like it there.
Mm.
And I do. So
wonderful.
Worked out well.
If you think back to Freshers Week, everyone would have been quite nervous meeting people with all your kind of musical experience and achievements and aspirations at the time. How did Freshers Week meet or did not meet your expectations of Cambridge?
Oh, I hated Freshers Week, I'm not gonna lie. I was actually saying this to my mum earlier, because a close friend of mine is about to go and do freshers at another uni, and she texted me this morning and said, I'm so terrified, like, how did you do it, how did you move into uni? And I was giving her advice, but I said to my mum, I was like, if you told me in Freshers Week that I would love Cambridge, I would not believe you, because Freshers Week did not, I think there's such high expectations
to meet everyone
and have such a great time.
How did you introduce yourself at the start?
Well, there were three Annies in my year, so that made it slightly difficult. So I think I just became Music Annie, because I just released Feeling Wavy and put that on our freshers group chat.
Ooh.
So I think...
So you were quite cool and you were on a high.
I think that's how people knew me.
Yeah.
Or distinguished between the Annies.
Did you like that?
Yeah, I think so. I think my songs are a big part of my...
Yeah, yeah.
Identity and how people know me, so
And did you find like musical societies like ADCs and stuff, and how did you stumble across it, or did you always want to join them?
In the first term I did just college music, so like the choir. Actually auditioned for the choir because I do music, and my DOS had been like, you're going to be in the choir.
Yeah.
Because I wasn't planning on doing it, and now I love it. But then I did ADC in the second term, because I thought, because I'd been thinking maybe I want to go and do sound design and tech, theatre tech. It's like a career path.
Mm.
But it wasn't really for me.
Mm.
But I'm still glad I did it, because if I hadn't done it, I wouldn't know that it wasn't for me.
Are you someone who has to do things for a while to see whether you like it? And are you open-minded to just try something completely different?
I'm definitely a try before you buy sort of person.
Yeah.
And definitely at Cambridge, I've done like a range of different things. Some of them loved, some of them not so much. I think trying is useful, because it eliminates even if you don't like it, it eliminates things and then will change where you go. But if you don't try anything, then you just always continue in the same line.
But do you ever feel a tension between staying on track for one thing, like for you with piano, like getting to the diploma stage, grade 8 distinction in trombone as well, which I play trombone as well.
Do you?
So not nearly as well.
Oh, I haven't played for ages.
But it seems like you're someone who somehow simultaneously can focus on one path and go really far while also trying a number of different things. And is there a tension between going really far and just continuing and persevering and being so-called gritty versus going, okay, well, I'm going to give this up and try something else because I might be better suited elsewhere?
Yeah, I think there definitely is a bit of tension with kind of just balancing everything.
Like width and depth. You know?
Yeah. I mean, my diplomas and grade 8s I did pre-uni. And that was a time that was basically solely focused on school and music. I didn't really do much else. I didn't really have a raging social life. But definitely at uni, it's been more difficult to prioritise the width and depth. I know this year I'm having to give some stuff up in order to prioritise my kind of long-term goal of going back to Guildhall.
Maybe a better word than width is breadth, but
yeah, that'd be it. I was thinking width doesn't sound quite right.
Oh, so at what age did you get your basically diplomas in or grade 8s in trombone, singing, piano? Which actually, like, for most people, just getting one thing to that, it just so casually, oh, yeah, I'm diploma grade 8 in all of these things.
I got my first diploma in piano in year 10.
Wow.
I think.
Mm.
Yeah, I think it was year 10. Oh, gosh, I'm trying to think. And then I think the other three, so another diploma and the two distinctions, were in sixth form. But I think it never felt like, now I look back on it, I'm like, wow, that's quite impressive. But it never felt like that because I was always surrounded by people
who also
had stuff like that. And even at Cambridge, a lot of people who don't do anything musical have like multiple grade 8s and diplomas under their belt. So,
yeah, it's really interesting how our environment gives us a biased perception of our actual ability.
Yeah, definitely.
Where I think our limitedness is natural to just compare ourselves with our neighbours. I think there was a study done on winning the lottery or something, and it was like once someone wins the lottery, the person who most struggles is like their neighbor or someone who's similar to them because they're always in a psychological kind of comparison. Doesn't have to be a malicious way, but we always just tag along to someone else. Wondering,
100%.
Did you have one or two people who were either in your cohort, your peers, or maybe just a little bit above where, you know, implicitly or explicitly, you always just try to compare yourself with them to see how you're progressing?
Sort of. At Guildhall, there were a couple of boys who were 2 or 3 years older than me. But obviously, we were still in the same classes. And they were just so much more knowledgeable than I was in year 10 and 11. And I always felt very inferior compared to them. But then, of course, naturally, obviously I wouldn't know as much. I hadn't been there for as long and I was younger, but I didn't have that perspective.
Yeah.
And I think singing-wise, my mum is an amazing singer and my sister is also really good. Mm. So I've always felt like I'm not actually
that
very good.
Mm.
And in reality, I just have a different voice, because I would try and obviously like copy the songs that they sung, which would be musical theatre and jazz and stuff like that. But my voice doesn't suit that. So obviously it's not going to sound very good.
Because of course we are going to sound different. But if you know that they're good singers, you just want to sound like them.
Yeah, exactly.
But if you sound like them, then you feel like you lose your individuality.
Yeah, exactly. I think just even very recently, I've kind of become a lot more confident with singing classically, but also in terms of a more singer-songwriter acoustic sound, which perhaps wouldn't suit their voices as much, but definitely suits mine.
A lot of it sounds like there's a lot of, again, tensions between the rational side of looking at things as objectively to the extent that we're capable of versus that emotional feeling in the moment. And it seems like to produce good music or to really thrive in this industry, sometimes you got to be irrational and you got to be quite emotionally driven.
Yeah, 100%. I think if you're not emotionally driven in the creative, at least for me, in the creative fields, you're not really going to get very far.
But is there a way to almost switch modes in our brain of, okay, now let's just let the emotion run and see where it takes me versus hold up for this matter or this period or this time or this task, I need to follow a very logical, rational, step-by-step approach.
Yeah, definitely. And sometimes it can be a bit jarring to switch between the two because they're so different. But I find when I produce, for example, a lot of that's very, very technical. So we'll be dealing with like frequency and all that sort of stuff, which is obviously very different to the emotional side. And you do have to switch between the two a lot. Or even when I write classical music, sometimes I'll just see where my hands take me on the keyboard and what feels right. And sometimes I will be quite methodical. And I mean, sometimes I use like random number generators and stuff like that to write. So it all really depends.
And as you get older with the academic side of you developing, and you know, we touched on a little bit about social inequality, we touched on a little bit about gender inequality, and lots of music addresses these current social movements concerning, like, say, feminism, etc. And I was wondering, has your academic training at Cambridge helped you to appreciate the social impact of music on societies in general? And
yeah, definitely. I think I did an interesting bit of research on club culture this year in one of my papers, and kind of queer theory behind that and the club as a kind of heterotopic space for realizing and imagining like a free queer identity for yourself and for other people. And I think that's really shaped how I approach writing. Because I think it's easy to get detached when you have your manuscript paper and you have your piano and you're like, I'm going to write this and not really think about the impact or where it's going to be performed or why it's going to be performed. But I think, so I think doing research on that and in classical settings, even things like religion, and the impact of music and religion can be really interesting.
And for you to do all those hymns, you know, Christmas carols, very tied up with an ideology, I guess it, religion thrive over time and culture because it touches people and it's a story and a moral framework or a way of thinking that passes on. And do you feel like being able to more systemically study the role of music and religion, for example, or other things, how has that changed you? I mean,
Well, I mean, it's definitely changed my compositional influences, and how I write and why I write. So I'm working on a piece at the moment that's kind of inspired by a fragment of chant, religious chant from the medieval Renaissance period that we've sung in the chapel choirs, but also I've studied stuff like that and the impacts of that. And this particular chant was to aid passage of souls into death from purgatory. And so my piece then is kind of an electronic reimagining of that passage into death. And I wouldn't have even thought of doing something like that had I not studied music. Or we did a whole module on 20th century music this year, and all of the kind of interesting techniques they use in a lot of that. And if I hadn't studied that, then I wouldn't I wouldn't think about things so differently.
And when you learn these new kind of connections throughout history, and does it give you more perspective about our kind of role in the current place that we have in history? Does it give you direction for what you want to achieve in your life?
Yeah, I think perhaps seeing the influence that some composers have had on things like social movements but even, I guess, kind of circling back to religion, like how music has either kind of helped to bridge the gap between sacred and secular. That's quite a big thing in the Renaissance period. I think it's helpful for me to know the impact that I'm having and be aware that sometimes the music that I write could have, but you never know, could have a major
You're going
impact.
To be in the future Oxford syllabus for music.
You never know.
There'll be a module just on the impact of Annie.
One can dream.
if there were such a module in a century's time, what do you kind of hope scholars then would write about your impact? Like, is there anything you want to achieve in this world?
I think would be for people like me, female composers, to feel a bit more empowered. Because, I mean, there is more recognition for female composers now than even there was 10 years ago, but we still have quite a way to go, so I'd kind of want to join that legacy.
You feel like you're standing on the shoulder of giants, that kind of?
Yeah, kind of. And especially women in electronic music, that's a very, very kind of under-recognised area. So I'd like to
be a part of it.
Yeah.
Further it.
Yeah.
That's really cool. Are you personally religious?
I'm not, no. I feel like I've always kind of ping-ponged back and forth between being not religious and sort of Christianity, but I just can't get into it. My sister is, but and I went to church a little bit when I was younger, and obviously singing the chapel choir means I'm in church quite a lot now. I appreciate some aspects.
What do you appreciate?
I really kind of like the ritualistic aspects.
The habitual gatherings,
and
the singing.
We have a really nice service at CATS called Night Songs. So it's candle lit, and there's some, you know, pretty music and words of prayer, and that's nice and soothing. But then it's more the history of oppression that is so entwined with Christianity for me makes it difficult to fully become part of
it. From a more secular lens then, what concepts, because I mean, take Christianity as an example where it it's obviously a way of understanding the world, of understanding the brokenness of why tragedies happen. You know, since the fall, for example, it was perfect and now it's not perfect, and humans are flawed, etc., etc. What aspects of it do you find, even from a secular lens, is just true, and what aspects of it do you find very difficult to grasp or to accept? Because you've been in so many services, the songs, and you've heard so many sermons. What do you agree with? What do you not agree with?
I think religion creates a really nice sense of community and collectivity, and I think that's really important. That's not just Christianity. I mean, that could be any religion. And I think having those social units, I think is really good. And also, I like the belief that there is, you know,
something more,
and like, I guess, something after death, someone with you and guiding you, and guardian angels and all that stuff sort of is the same in the same area. But then sometimes they do some readings in the chapel that I just don't agree with. I mean, I'm not a fan of the Adam and Eve one. And sometimes there's ones about slavery as well, and I'm like, ooh, big no. I just can't get on board with that. But I think, as I say, the ritual, habitual aspects of it, I think, are nice.
That's really interesting. And when you talk to your sister then, who believes it more than you, have you had much discussions about her, about music, religion, the intersections of... Because music does touch on the different areas of social life. And what I'm thinking is that, at least for me, you know, moving countries as well, as I grow, as I see different parts of the world, I appreciate more of the interconnectivity, and I'm more and more appreciative of just how nuanced things are. And religion is obviously one of those things that it's hard to have a black and white certainty. But for you, as you say, you're dabbling around, and what kind of conversations or topics have that dabbling around led you to with other people who you trust?
I mean, I don't actually massively talk about... We, in our family, we don't really talk about it that much. Though definitely I've spoken to my mum a little about the more oppressive side of religion. And I know I've always kind of struggled with the there is a higher power, because so many bad things happen in the world all the time, and I'm like, if there's a higher power, like, why? But I mean, obviously, I know,
it's like the classic problem of evil. It's an omnipotent, omnipresent, omnibenevolent God allow that to happen. It's really interesting. I mean, I've looked a lot into theology in the past year, and I think I've made a lot of progress for me personally, especially concerning the oppressive side of things.
And
I think one of the key turning points for me was reading like Martin Luther King's speech, because when you look at the civil rights movements, where religion's interesting because it's used on both sides, where you know, the Crusades and everything, it's almost like a religious mandate to go, but on the other hand, a lot of great social movements of empowerment have been motivated and mobilized by religious groups and religious concepts and ideas. And one of the things that Martin Luther King, I think, said was to those people who were owning slaves, like, are you following God enough or not enough? Or like, are you listening to God enough or not enough? And it just made me think where maybe there is a distinction between the infinite, the eternal God, or the conceptualization of God versus the finite, flawed people that we are. And in religions, God is perfect and God is love. God is good. So it's like, if you follow God strictly and if you follow God enough, then you probably wouldn't commit those crimes and you probably wouldn't oppress. You would treat other people the way that you want to be treated. So then I came probably to the conclusion that those people who use the name of religion to achieve their own personal end is actually just not following God enough, rather than following God too much.
Yeah.
Because if you follow God too much, then you should advance equality. You should
I definitely
go for kindness and all the compassion, you know, all the good qualities that surely we all have an intrinsic sense of what is good.
Yeah.
And with colonialism, for example, like taking children away from their family surely is not good.
Yeah, no, I 100% agree with that. I think just, I find when people use, I find it frustrating when people use, for example, kind of in abortion rights, when people use God as a front of why you shouldn't get an abortion.
Yeah.
But then I guess
it's like, it's really arrogant for anyone to claim God's mandate.
Yeah, exactly. But then it's also, at the same time, well, I guess religion is sort of, it is sort of enabling, at the same time, people to do that. But even if that wasn't the original intention, that is what is happening.
It's very hypocritical. I think scripture makes it very clear that we have no right to judge other people.
Yeah.
And like, we are all equal, and it's like, let God be God.
Yeah.
You're not, none of us are God, so we shouldn't have a, unless we're perfect, then we shouldn't have a right to say that your problems are worse than mine, you know. But it is really interesting, and I want to bring it back to maybe music and religion, where why do you think music is such a crucial part of human evolution, whether in the religious sense or not? Like, why has music been able to connect, and certain hymns and tunes and concepts have been able to be passed on so easily across different groups?
Yeah, I mean, for starters, it's something that can be done collectively. A lot of musical practices are done in groups, even like singing in a chapel choir. That's a collective practice of worship, arguably, even though obviously a lot of people are not religious who sing in the choir. And I think because, this is going to sound so cringy, but it is like a universal thing.
Yeah.
Music, you're not tied by language barriers because it's a different sort of language. So it can function cross-culturally and within cultures, which it can be a great thing, but can also be a really terrible thing, because it can, for example, colonialism, music was a really important tool at kind of and has always been a tool of propaganda and emphasizing particular motives, I guess, in a similar way to how people can use God to argue for their own personal motive. People can use music in the same way.
Which sounds like bizarre, people using God, like it's just
it's so odd, but I guess that is what they're doing, really.
So if music is so universal and everyone has a instinctive almost sense of it.
Yeah.
What is, like, is there a hierarchy between what is better music? Like, what is, like, objectivity even mean in music, if it exists at all?
I don't think it, well, objectivity does exist in, in biased senses, and ones that I don't agree with, because people might place.
So if you don't agree with it, that's a subjective, then is it really objective?
Well, the thing is, I think people would say that, like, Western classical music is, for a very basic point of view, Western classical music is more complex and better than music from other continents.
Sounds like colonialist.
which is very colonialist, and I don't agree with that. I think so that would be an objective point of view. I think music is much more subjective because I don't think you can actually rank things that are so different and also so tied up in cultural meaning and cultural importance. You can't just say this is better than that, because it might not be trying to be good. It might be trying to do something completely different.
Then how do you work back to another tension? There's lots of tension in here. In order to make this a career, you need, you know, the reality is that you need other people, lots of other people, to like and appreciate and rank your music better than other people. And is that, do you think that economic pressure of the world and of reality hinders or support your creative and individual personal subjective pursuit of musical excellence?
I would say it definitely hinders. If I could, I would not try and earn any money and just make the music that I want to make. But realistically, that won't get me that far. So I think I have a pen pal in France, and we were talking about, well, in the last letter I got from her, I've been talking about who I am as an artist and how I don't know who I am because I feel like multiple artists and multiple selves. And she said that, you know, that's okay. You can be multiple artists. And I think that's true here, in terms of I can be an artist that caters for more popular audiences for economic security, but I can also explore what I want to explore regardless of money. So I think that would be the ideal balance between the two, the more commercially viable and then the real creative.
If money was not a worry at all and you won the lottery now, 100 million, how would your life change? We'll get a large size coffee.
Yeah, a large, not a medium. I think
you can then go to a studio.
Yeah, I was gonna say, I think I would definitely kit myself out with some good equipment. I don't think it would actually change my goals very much, because I'd still want to go to Guildhall, for example, and study. I think I'd travel more to absorb
different cultures,
because I think that is also really, I find
culture's a very buzzword, it means everything. What in particular do you think, when you say the word culture in this musical context, what does culture mean?
For me, it's just way of life, like how, and that's in itself very broad. So I'm planning next summer on going to Japan, which I've heard is quite individualist culturally. And I think it'll be interesting to absorb that, but I also want to go to some monasteries and see how religion, their religious culture, is different to over here.
That's so interesting. And have you had many chances to, either at Cambridge in a collegiate environment or through your own travels or research, like, do you have an anecdote or experience where someone's way of life, their culture, their differences really just made you question your own way of life, your own way of seeing the world? And have you ever really changed your mind on anything?
That's a good question. I feel like I've always lived in a bit of a bubble, really, kind of going from Kent to Cambridge, and I haven't really, unfortunately, got to travel much in my life. I guess the closest thing would be seeing how people with a lot of money how their way of life and how just how they view things and how they are is different to how I am. Because I think we've never had lots of money. I mean, obviously we're not super poor because we still have a house and everything. But in Cambridge, some people are crazy, crazy rich, and at Guildhall as well. And I think that's made me a lot more grateful for what I have in a way. Even though I have less, seeing how almost arrogant people can be and how much they take stuff for granted has made me more appreciative of the smaller things which I took for granted.
That's really thoughtful reflection. It is, yeah, I mean, so much of life just being able to breathe. It's a real privilege to experience and to see and to have our five senses. And I know that definitely recently starting work and kind of moving cities, it's always so easy to look at what I don't have or to compare and to feel like things could be better.
Definitely.
But if we just appreciate what has gone well. And I was wondering, could you maybe elaborate on some more of the little things in your life that you have perhaps taken for granted for a while?
Well, I mean, it's not really a little thing, it's quite a big thing. I had a bit of an accident in year 9 and lost some hearing in my left ear. And I think I just took for granted having two working ears before that. And although I can still hear out of my left ear, it's different. And it does make... it's impacted quite a bit, really. It's made social situations harder to hear people. It's made music, obviously, a lot harder, especially when I'm trying to produce, because so much stuff is in, like, stereo, that then stuff feels uneven. So that's definitely hearing is a big thing that I took for granted. And also sight. I usually wear glasses. I've got contact lenses in today. But I think, I mean, I don't so much take that for granted because I'm actually quite blind without them. But I think a lot of people, 20/20 vision, take that for granted.
And I guess many years have passed since then. Do you think that loss of something, an aspect, a sense perhaps in this case, has forced other senses to like compensate? Because I often hear like some of the greatest artists or musicians, they have lost their senses, and but because of that, like Beethoven, you know, not being able to see, is that right? Or is it Mozart?
I think it's hear. Oh, is it see?
Yeah, I mean growing up, when I was taking piano lessons, often hear my piano teachers talk about the idea of like artistic inspiration and just trusting that we are unique and we all have our own special gifts, and our so-called deficiencies are actually can be our strength at the same time.
Yeah.
And have you found that where there has been surprising benefits or compensations that have come from it that makes you unique and special? And
I mean, like, I guess in a two-pronged way. Socially, I mean I lip read quite a bit, but not being able to hear as well, so finding it difficult to keep up in conversations sometimes, I think has made me more keen to include other people. Sometimes you see
more empathetic.
Sometimes you see someone and you can tell they want to say something, or they just said something and someone, like, everyone had just ignored them. So I like to try and make an effort to include people. I think that also stems from kind of difficulties at school as well.
That's very thoughtful, because kids often, when you struggle a bit socially and when you get bullied, there's a choice. You either try and find that power yourself by finding someone weaker and bully, or you can grow that empathy.
Yeah.
Try let other people not feel the same way as you
yeah,
do.
Yeah, really exactly.
Heartwarming that you chose the latter Thank one. And it's really kind of.
And then, oh, I did have another thought. What was I going to say? Oh yeah, and then kind of, for the other element of it, I guess. I feel some of my composition has become a bit more cognitive. As opposed to like solely relying on my ears. I think about things a bit more, which can be, because I think some people have this conception that artists just write and they just sit down at the piano and they're writing and they're not really thinking about it. But that's definitely not true. Or at least I don't find that is true. Maybe it is for some people. And I from that point onwards, I definitely became more conscious and I guess almost academic in some of my music writing.
What are you good at? What are you proud of?
I don't know. What a question. I'm proud of going to Cambridge, I guess. Classic, but I think I'm just proud of like how far I've come, kind of as a rounded person compared to like school me. If she saw me now,
would be proud.
So I guess in that sense I am, and. I mean, also, I got diagnosed with ADHD like a year and a half ago, and it's always quite difficult just in daily life to manage that. So I'm proud that I've sort of managed that.
So resilience sounds like a really
I guess resilience would be what I'm most proud of, and then also like being able to harness my creativity and. Small things that I produce, I'm proud of those smaller projects.
How
as well.
Have you been able to be so resilient? Is it just by circumstance?
I think I've
by
always.
By choice?
I think it's definitely a choice. I think my family have been really important in that as well. Whenever something happens, I get knocked down, I just choose to build myself back up, and I know that it will get better. And I think that's the way to be resilient. People aren't just born. Well, some people might be, but most people aren't born resilient. You have to try to be. It's like a lot of people aren't born like super kind or empathetic. You actually have to like try to be and make a conscious effort a lot of the time. Some people are. Some people are just angels.
I mean, my belief, and obviously it's hard to know for sure, I think we are born with all the dispositions to do all the good, and it's about it's that nature and nurture debate.
Yeah.
I deeply believe that we're all fundamentally good and loving.
Yeah.
It's just making sure that society has the conditions to support people as we all inevitably make mistakes, and we all have our temptations, and we all have our flaws and insecurities and whatever, and you know, this world isn't perfect and it does put us through many different trials. And I was wondering, on that note about resilience, some people, you know, for example, they write down their goals, some people, you know, bite their teeth just to carry on. Is there anything practically in particular that you do to be resilient after some misfortunes or bad things have happened or things that haven't gone your way? What does resilience look like on a practical level for Annie?
I'm trying to think, really. It kind of depends what's happened. So if something's happened, you know, socially, then I might try and like surround myself with those people that make me feel uplifted. But if something's happened academically, then generally I'll be a bit more practical in terms of going back to the drawing board, making my lists, writing my goals, doing my research instead of just giving up and going into descending into a slump. I mean, sometimes obviously you do give up and descend into a slump, but then I think there's ways you can, small changes to daily life can kind of pull yourself out of that instead of staying there.
And when you said how you know that things will get better, why do you know? How do you know? Where do you get that purpose?
I mean, and because belief? Things have happened before that I've thought have been like the complete end of the world. I'm still here. I'm still kicking. And I can think back to how I felt in certain situations, and then I think 3 months later, I wasn't that bothered by them. So I know deep down that whatever happens, I will not. Feelings are temporary.
And have you, because, I mean, our Cambridge, our environment and just the modern world with social media and everything is, there's so much anxiety, whether people acknowledge it or not, with your understanding and with your own perspective and your own personal, I guess, experiences. Have you ever tried to calm other people, friends, and give, you know, children perhaps, and just a bit of mentoring to give them further perspective on that?
Yeah, I think quite often, I mean, without realizing, I think for some of my friends, I'm sort of that shoulder to cry on, which is really quite a rewarding feeling. And it's nice that people trust me. I think sometimes people try and just actually give too much advice. So I guess instead of like mentoring people necessarily, sometimes just being there and listening can be the most powerful and useful thing you can do for someone.
Lots of psychologists say that most of their job is just validating people's thoughts, that, hey, you know, what you're experiencing is normal, and it's normal to feel this way, and we all just seem to have this deep fear of being quirky, as you mentioned before. That's really interesting. And I see that you've done like Pink Week and various like volunteering initiatives. So Pink Week's obviously for breast cancer, and trying to raise funds in a practical way. What motivated you? Because that's a lot of time and effort outside of your already busy commitments.
I know there's a few people in my life who've had kind of experiences with cancer, breast cancer. So that was definitely a bit of a motivator. But also, I just love raising money. Like, it doesn't even need to be for Pink Week specifically, because I've done other charity things. I guess it's a sense of meaning. And also, like, in a slightly selfish way, I get a lot of pleasure from like charity work.
You feel like you're making a real tangible difference.
And that's in a world where it feels like so much is out of my control. It's really nice to do something that will, I know, will make a difference. I think that's what's so nice.
So implicitly then, do you feel like the world allocates resources in a very inefficient or immoral or not a, like, is the system working?
No. Not at all. I mean, I don't profess to be able to speak on this well, but I think just like the privatization of basic human needs is quite a big issue.
Because in our ideal world, then we wouldn't need to always fundraise, and the allocation of resource would already be there.
But that is an ideal world. I don't think we'll ever get there. I think every system has its flaws. But I think maybe even if we were in a world where we didn't need to fundraise or do things like that, people would find other ways that they would still do that.
Okay.
If that makes sense. I feel like people, it's like what you said about people being innately, like, kind.
Yeah.
I think to some extent, people just want to help other people. Mm. And fundraising and charity is obviously a big way to do that. But if we didn't need fundraising and charity, I think there would still be other ways that people would try and help.
To go above and beyond.
Yeah.
Which is actually quite beautiful to think about that. There are always generous people who are willing to prioritize other people in a world that seems to always be profit driven, that seems to always be greedy.
Yeah.
That I do think the good outweigh the bad, as hard as it can be.
Yeah.
Difficult to believe.
Yeah, and exactly.
Feel sometimes. So you're overall an optimist, you reckon?
I think so. I think so. I feel like I went through a stage where I'd say that I was a pessimist. Okay. I don't know why.
About?
Just life. I think I was just being a moody teen, to be honest. I think I like to see the best in people, which can at times end up not so well for me. But I don't think I would change that. I like to see the best in people.
I think
it's a good way to live. And I think I often feel a little bit sorry for people who are very pessimistic, because like how depressing life must be to just always automatically see the bad.
It's very unsustainable.
Yeah I mean, don't get me wrong, sometimes I'm not optimistic at all.
I guess this optimism pessimism thing I've thought about for a very long time, and I think right now I think it's important to learn when to be optimistic and when to be pessimistic.
Yeah.
Like when I'm trying to work hard and to achieve things, I want to be optimistic that what I'm doing contributes towards something that I can improve in.
Yeah.
Like that growth mindset of I can be better and not be so bothered by past mistakes and past inadequacies. But then I try and be a pessimist, say, when I'm budgeting and just like thinking about risk and thinking about the different possibilities, because you don't want to go blindly into, like, for example, it wouldn't be very wise if I just quit my job now without anything else to replace that with, and just think, oh, as if I quit it, then something better will come along. Like the grass isn't necessarily always greener.
I think that's perhaps optimism to the extreme.
Yeah, like a false sense of
hope. Yeah, I think that would be
like toxic positivity.
Yeah, beyond a healthy level of optimism.
Yeah.
I think, and perhaps instead of, or at least for me, perhaps instead of that being also being a bit pessimistic, it would just be being rational.
Yeah.
Logical. Like, yes, I can be optimistic, but also sometimes something is not going to work out, or I need to have a backup plan in place.
Yeah.
Though quite often I don't. But yeah.
And how much do you find, what makes you laugh, like on a day-to-day level? Do you find yourself smiley a lot, laughing a lot?
I'd say people.
People.
People make me laugh and smile. But it depends. It's got to be certain people. I'm quite introverted. Deep down. Surprisingly, yes. This is a recent...
Discovery.
I'm like a people person. So I'm like good... I find I'm like good at talking to people. But I also love my alone time. And I feel most recharged when I'm either with like people I'm really close to or by myself. But then I wouldn't want to be by myself all the time because...
Oh yeah, that would be lonely.
That would be very lonely. And I enjoy people's company. It really depends on how I feel.
Yeah. Well, I guess in the context of, like, giving you a legacy-worthy interview, you know, as we talked about, snapshot of where you are, we've touched on some random things here and there, which has been really interesting to, I guess, exchange some thoughts, and I'm sure we're all developing, and if we have a chat in a few years' time, we'll be quite different. And also, hopefully this recording, we can both look back in decades time and just laugh at.
Yeah.
Is there anything else that you feel like is important for you to just keep in this recording? Or else I've got just a round of like rapid fire questions and we'll wrap up.
I'm happy for the rapid fire questions.
Yes, the first obvious rapid fire question, favourite artist?
Oh my gosh, I could not choose. There's too many. Yeah.
How many songs do you think you'll write in your life? If you were to put a number?
100.
100. Which country is next on your bucket list?
I don't know. Not a country, but a continent, South America.
If you could, if God could reveal himself to you, what's one prayer that you wish to be answered?
To be happy, always.
Always. Salt or sweet?
Sweet.
Cats or dogs?
Dogs.
Favorite morning breakfast?
Porridge with banana.
If you weren't studying your current degree at Cambridge, what would you be studying?
Maybe history of art or psychology.
If you could have a 1 hour chat with anybody alive or dead, who would that be?
Freddie Mercury.
I guess second to last question then. A typical, maybe an essay-like question, but should we? And should we, or how can we separate the art from the artist?
I think we should to an extent. I think it depends on the art. It's quite often, art can be very much tied up in its context, and that's a very important part to keep in mind, but sometimes art can be not really at all tied up in its context and can just exist. I think it's not black and white, it's kind of more of a spectrum. But I think even the art that's tied up in more like negative contexts,
yep.
I think it's okay. For example, I'm thinking like the music of Wagner and the Nazi regime. Like, it's okay to still enjoy listening to that. That doesn't make you a Nazi. But I think it's also really important to know how that music was used harmfully and to acknowledge that.
And correspondingly, do you think cancel culture is valid? Is it good? Is it?
I think to an extent. I think sometimes it's taken a bit far.
Because as we said, people make mistakes.
Yeah.
And often we find people pulling out old tweets of like 2008 when the world was slightly perhaps different.
Yeah, I think.
But obviously there are things that I feel like are universal, and there are things that
I think cannot be compromised. People do things that if someone who wasn't in the public eye did that, people wouldn't bat an eyelid.
Yeah.
But they just see someone in the public eye and think, I want to tear them down.
Yeah.
And I sometimes think it's like a jealousy thing. But then of course,
so when you become a global pop star, do you worry about the public scrutiny and pressure?
Definitely.
Imagine millions of people trying to tear you down.
Gosh. No, I'm scared already. I think a lot of people who get cancelled, though, don't perhaps have the balance between public and private quite right. Because it tends to be a lot of influencers.
Because we know how like power corrupts, and when when you get fame, people treat you differently.
Yeah.
And I used to think that self-control is, well, as long as you stay humble, it'll be fine. Yeah. But increasingly as I get older, the more like autobiographies I read, you just start to realize how everyone around your circle treats you in a certain way, that it's really hard to maintain that objectivity.
Yeah.
And it's really easy for our ego to just feel like we are top of the world and that we are invincible and that we are.
Yeah.
But we're not.
Yeah,
you know,
I think a lot of.
We're all one mistake away from.
Have like that sense of entitlement.
Yeah.
And I think that can lead to them doing things that get them cancelled.
Yeah, yeah.
So I think the root of it would be to not be so entitled, to be a bit more humble.
Which I feel like for you, with your experience having had the difficulties, it does ground you and it
does definitely
give you a reminder of the preciousness, as you say, of life. That's really cool. Well, I guess final question, you know, taking into account all the things that we have, you know, talked about with your upbringing, you know, the difficulties of like struggling to fit in, of like, you know, starting to compose songs at age of 6. I think in an interview you mentioned how it started with like jingles.
And, yeah.
You know, finding your identity and still trying to find your identity, connecting with different social groups, but always feeling like they're struggling a bit to fit in, but not always necessarily a bad thing. Being a composer, singer-songwriter in a at times male-dominated industry, experiencing that kind of elitism of, for you, not always being able to afford the equipment or the facilities to be able to have an equal playing field with other people that they take for granted. For you to have gone to a really good school, I'm sure you sat the 11 plus exam and done really well. To enter those competitions, you know, such as the singing, the Christmas Carol competition, and winning, and you know, being recognised as someone who is both musical, creative, and also academic, having your sister, you know, go to Cambridge before you to set the bar high with mum as such a talented singer, so that you've always been in a relatively elite environment, so feeling like you're perhaps not good enough and perhaps very different. Having your weekends in the, you know, junior guildhall and always having something to look forward to, but having that pressure of needing to finish your homework, needing to clear up time so that you can have time to have your more creative pursuits, getting into Cambridge, struggling in Freshers Week and just finding it difficult to understand, I guess, the social logics, and even more highlighting the social inequalities that there are, differentiating yourself between the three Annies and establishing your identity as the music Annie, having your first song, which is actually your second song, published, and then, you know, recently having your second song and dealing with all the rumors and everything. And I guess that is the it's chaotic. Life is wild, and people we live in a community of different people, and we are obviously so impacted by others. And but for you to navigate that and to persist with your songwriting, finding inspiration from all sorts of different regions, genres, people, experiences, processing traumatic things, having the accidents, and being resilient and really appreciating the little things that other people take for granted, to draw inspirations from other singers like Adele, for example, to think about the more global historical issues such as that are tied with religion, tied with feminism, civil rights movements, trying to understand our positionality in an evolving context, nuanced, diverse world, realizing that you have at times been in a bubble at Kent, but knowing that you want to go experience different things, such as like going to Japan with a different way of living, different way of life, different way of conceptualization. When you think about all of that and the goals that you want to have and trying to make a difference, such as through fundraising, finding a sense of meaning and control, and seeing the goodness in a, at times, chaotic world, what's one message, quote, or saying that you wish every educator, music teacher, headmaster, headmistress, every leader, every role model, every parent would promote, and every child who we're all trying to find our place in the world, trying to find our contribution, how our unique gifts and strength could help us to serve, would internalize. Like, what do you feel like is your life philosophy and ideal, summarized succinctly as a motto almost?
Try everything that you can, and if something doesn't make you happy, don't do it. So
that's great. And yeah, I just want to say that when I was like doing my research on you this past week, I was like, oh wow, she's like obviously incredibly impressive, you know, with all the diplomas and all the things that you have and continue to achieve. And even though I hadn't met you in person then, I felt that sense of boldness to be yourself and to be authentic, and that unshyness to make a difference through creative means and through actions of service. And I think what struck me about meeting you now today is how patient you are, how easygoing you are. You know, even though I was locked out of my room, wasn't able to pick you up at the station, that chaoticness, your calmness and your empathy and your understanding really stood out. And I think I feel very privileged at the moment and very grateful that we have been able to sort out this conversation. And even though I don't have my notes as well as I would have liked to, it just felt really easy to talk with you. And I appreciate your honesty, and I hope you found this to be at least a memorable experience to have.
Yeah, it's been very rewarding. And I also feel privileged to chat with number one BNOC.
You will be hopefully number one BNOC for the world when you're the global pop star. But hopefully by then you would have learned to balance the difference between private and personal so that you don't get scrutinized as much.
Yes. Yes, that'd be nice.
What have you got for the rest of the day?
Not much. Gonna go back home, spend some time with my family.
Great. Well, it was lovely to meet you, and all the best for your next year at Cambridge.
Thank you.
I look forward to the release of your next two songs. And I guess I don't know the specific lyrics, I know it is more vulnerable, but I hope you can continue to have the courage you have to be truthful and to be honest, and I'm sure good things will come your way.
Thank you.
All the best.
Thank you.